Companies are more dependent than ever on third-party providers, and that means they need continuous visibility and monitoring of their external partners' threat landscape. If that sounds like your company, you want to join Looking Glass product manager Brandon Dobrik and Security Ledger editor-in-chief Paul Roberts, that's me, on March 20th at 2 p.m. for a webinar on developing round-the-clock third-party advantage. Brandon and I will discuss what you need to assess vendors in the modern cyber environment and provide an introduction to Looking Glass's cyber situational awareness platform, which provides you with a map of your cyber risks so that you can identify vulnerabilities before your adversary does. To learn more, point your browser to securityledger.com/third-party. That's one word, securityledger.com/third-party. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. Presidents have followed many different paths to office, but to date, we haven't had a hacker president. That may soon change. In a blockbuster story released last week, Reuters reporter Joseph Men let drop that one of the leading contenders in the crowded field of Democratic Party candidates for the presidency, Beto O'Rourke, was a member of the iconic hacking group, the Cult of the Dead Cow, as a teenager growing up in El Paso, Texas. Men's revelation is startling, if for no other reason than that it builds a bridge that nobody thought could be built between the anarchic hacker and BBS online subculture of the 1980s and 1990s to the button-down world of Washington, D.C., where O'Rourke served Texas' 16th congressional district as a member of the House of Representatives. But to hear Joseph Men tell it, Beto's membership in Cult of the Dead Cow may not be that surprising if you've been paying attention. Everything from O'Rourke's position on key policy issues like net neutrality to his uncanny knack for garnering media attention and a massive online following might be seen as products of his formative years and experiences as a member of the Cult of the Dead Cow, where he contributed as a writer, an organizer, and a system administrator for one of the group's online BBSs or forums. A published author and one of the most respected technology journalists in the business, Joseph Men got the O'Rourke scoop as part of extensive research he's been doing on Cult of the Dead Cow for a forthcoming book entitled Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. In this exclusive interview with Security Ledger Podcast, I talk with Joe about how he first got wind about a CDC member who was walking the halls of Congress and why membership in the Cult of the Dead Cow might just be a great preparation for the leader of the free world.
I'm Joseph Men. I'm an investigative technology reporter for Reuters and author.
Joe, let me say, first of all, congratulations on the new book that's coming out June 4th and on the really big scoop that you had this week on presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke and his links to Cult of the Dead Cow.
Thanks. It's a real relief to get it out there. I've been sitting on this particular piece of information for a long time, and I was constantly worried about being scooped, and it's a relief to be able to sleep through the night again.
I don't know about you, but I always feel like if I'm sitting on a scoop, it's kind of like you're holding this diamond in your hand and realizing that if things don't go right, that the diamond's just going to turn back into a pile of carbon and be completely valueless. Like if somebody beats you, then this wonderful thing that you are holding suddenly has next to no value.
Right.
Now you're doing a Me Too story and no one really cares about
this. Right. I mean, I hate this part of the business. I love journalism. I picked journalism when I was 15. It's all I've wanted to do.
Yeah. Good for you.
And, yeah. You know, I'm extremely lucky that I get to do what I wanted to do when I was a teenager. But the sort of the gamesmanship part of it is not why I'm in it.
Yeah.
And the nerves and the tension over this, over who goes first. I'm an investigative guy. I've always been an investigative guy. I like to come up with stuff that is hidden and important and sort of expose it and explain it. You know, who beats who by, you know, a couple minutes is not my idea of a good time.
It is a unique type of torture to be sitting on a really big scoop and not be able to let go of it. And I guess people who aren't reporters don't really know what that feels like, but it's one of the worst feelings ever. And it makes you super paranoid. How long have you been sitting on this scoop?
About 18 months, which is just torture. It's like being like an elephant's pregnancy. And what happened was that I decided to write a book about the Cult of the Dead Cow a couple years ago. And when I decided that that was the book I wanted to write, I knew that they had a congressman. and I didn't know which congressman, and they were protecting him. But I thought that was okay. Maybe I'll find out who it is by the time I turn in the book, and maybe I won't. But it's amazing that they have one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of many, many reasons I want to write about the group. I got the deal to write the book with Public Affairs, and I started to see these articles fly by. You know, I don't pay a lot of attention to politics, not more than they have to, but I started to see these articles fly by about Beto O'Rourke because he was entering the race for Senate in Texas. And the fact that he was from Texas, the fact that he was the right age, the fact that he was in a punk band.
Mm-hmm.
And that some of the people in CDC had been pointing to him on social media, had been saying like, "Hey, here's an interesting candidate," or something like that. You know, they were posing it as a, you know, a stop Ted Cruz thing.
Yeah,
but they were also saying nice things about Beto, and I'm like, "Holy shit, that's the guy!"
And if I had to guess, there are people who don't typically get that involved in like statewide political races.
I would say no. I mean, there's a range of them,
yeah.
And they live different places, and they care about different things, and they have different issues, and they have different politics. But you know, it was mildly unusual. So anyway, so I made a guess, and they wouldn't say yes, and they wouldn't say no, and I'm like, oh, that's got to be him. But they wouldn't confirm it unless I promised that I wouldn't report it until after the November election, because they didn't want to hurt their buddy. And mm-hmm. that was okay with me, because I was writing a book. I was already on leave. You know, I'm trying to tell the story of three decades, not like one race in one state. So I said, well, you know, it's tough to give up that scoop, but I'm not going to get it any other way. The very small number of people at that point knew the truth. There was no way I was going to get it unless I agreed to the embargo. And it was still going to be a good story afterwards, especially if he won. I mean, that would be amazing. A sitting Senate, and it's amazing that there was a sitting congressman who was in CDC, but a senator would be even better. So, you know, maybe he's going to win, probably he won't, but I'm not going to get the story unless I agree. So I agreed. And then I met Beto and I said, look, I know that you're in this group and I want to write about it as part of this book. It's a fascinating story. It's not going to appear until after the November election. Do you agree? And he said, okay.
And how did you reach out to him?
It was at a fundraiser in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And I was invited by one of the hosts.
Did you sort of be like, could we step aside and have a conversation? Or I'm guessing you didn't throw this out in mixed company there at the fundraiser.
It was a side conversation towards the end.
I'm picturing you guys like in some side bedroom or something.
No, it was just a corner of the room, and
yeah,
you know, this is not a big apartment. This being San Francisco, and you know, not
yeah.
a lap of luxury in San Francisco, and it was a make your own tacos or burritos thing. There's wine in plastic cups. And, you know, it was early on fundraising. It was his first fundraiser in San Francisco, I believe his first in California, and this is early days. So this is in the primary. For the Democratic primary for Senate, the Senate race in Texas. And it wasn't at all clear he was going to win that. Nobody knew where this was going. You know, I don't know what his thinking was, but in agreeing yeah. to talk to me. But I think it was, you know, either I'm going to win this race and I'm going to be in the Senate and I have 6 years to live this down.
Yeah.
Or he's going to lose and he'll be out of politics and it's not going to be that big a deal that his hackered teens will be exposed. Nobody expected that he was going to lose the race and then become even bigger than he was.
When you kind of confronted Beto O'Rourke about this and told him that you knew about his membership in Cult of the Dead Cow, did he seem surprised or taken aback or worried? I mean, what was his reaction like?
He was actually very cool about it. I mean, cool in the sort of the temperature sense. You know, he didn't seem shocked or surprised. You know, he rolled with it. And I was surprised. I guess maybe like a really slick politician would have said like, would have hidden, you know, being upset about it if they were, but I didn't, that wasn't my read of it. I mean, I thought he was like, okay. Yeah, it's, you know, I can see why it's a good story. I mean, I think he knew that I was coming at it from a perspective of serious journalism, of longtime security journalism, and not like a tabloidy way. I mean, I think that's just my vibe. And so, you know, I'm sure at some level it was alarming to have the prospect of this come out. But if it is going to come out, I mean, you would want it to be through someone like me that is giving it a book-length treatment. And part of this is the evolution of what hacking means, you know, why they're increasingly valuable to society and important. That's the context, not like, oh my God, he wrote, you know, weirdo poems as a 15-year-old about cows.
So let's talk about Cult of the Dead Cow, okay? So the title of your new book, Joseph Men, is Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. For listeners who may not be familiar with Cult of the Dead Cow, could you just tell us a little bit about who this group was and also, I guess, how you got interested in them as a subject of a book?
Yeah, absolutely. So Cult of the Dead Cow is probably the oldest, and there's like a geek argument about this right now, but probably the oldest surviving hacking group in the United States. So they were founded, depending on your source, in 84 or 86, and when it was text files on bulletin boards. And so these various people in, starting in Lubbock, Texas, they each had bulletin boards, and this is the very early days of modems, 300 baud modems, incredibly slow connections. The gathering place in those days online were on bulletin boards. And there were bulletin boards, a lot of them were about computing. Some of them were about, other hobbies. Some were about politics, whatever. But it was a pain in the butt. If you didn't have like an academic, a university way to get on the early internet, or some giant tech corporation you worked for, then you had to use an acoustic coupler, a modem, super cumbersome, super slow. But the object was to get to these bulletin boards and find sort of people like you that you could talk to. And it was asynchronous. So you would leave a message and other people would see it later. And there were some postings that stayed, mostly text files. Or ASCII art, I suppose. And then there are also like pirated, Apple games and that sort of thing, which, there were boards devoted to that sort of thing. And that was the roots of this group. It was a bunch of different bulletin board sysop. And then, a couple of flukes of evolution, they wound up becoming much, much more important like 10 years later. What happened was, they were funny and they collected these text files, they numbered these text files and they sent them out, and they covered a lot of topics. Most of them were not technical. Some of them made fun of like the more sophisticated hackers in groups like Legion of Doom and Masters of Deception. The guys who were doing sort of more criminal suspect stuff, like breaking into AT&T and that sort of thing. Some of the kids, and they were kids in the Cult of the Dead Cow, looked up to those guys and envied them, but also sort of like mocked them for their sort of eliteness or whatever. The other guys got broken up and arrested in some celebrated cases that, among other things, spawned the Electronic Frontier Foundation and sort of broader awareness of what hackers could do. But the Cult of the Dead Cow survived because it was more of like a social club for hackers. And they were like, they were Switzerland on MOD versus LOD and various other sort of internecine hacker warfare. They're where like these guys went out and blew off steam. One of them founded HoHoCon, originally known as XmasCon, which was one of the first hacker cons, and Jeff Moss was one of the people who went to one of those, and Jeff Moss founded DEF CON and Black Hat later. So the hacker con scene belongs to Cult of Dead Cows in a lot of ways. There were some earlier ones, SummerCon, but HoHoCon was the first that had law enforcement openly attending and journalists attending, as opposed to just a bunch of teenagers getting drunk and telling war stories. They were admired within the hacking scene. They were funny. They were sort of like a social, like lightning rod or whatever. And as a result, people who were serious hackers, wanted to join and sort of got brought in. And that's where you had early overlap with the Loft there in Boston. Eventually, four members of the Loft were also in CDC. The most celebrated of them include Mudge.
Pete Zydko, yep.
Yeah, you're right. Peter Zydko, who went on to run DARPA's cyber program. And then do secret projects at Google. And Chris Rue, alias Dildog, who founded Veracode with the Lost Chris Weissobel. Technically, super sophisticated group of people.
Cult of the Dead Cow is really almost like a network of different BBSs maintained by group members. How did they sort of coordinate?
So that's true. They all had their own bulletin boards, and they all communicated actually on a secret part of the founder's home bulletin board. Demon Roach Underground was the name of it, and there was a secret part of it that only they would have access to, and they would talk about stuff. I guess it's already out in the story. So the founder's Kevin Wheeler, and on stage he was Grandmaster Rate, amazing stage presence, but in his real life is actually quite reclusive. So the way the bulletin boards work is they would basically all publish Cult of the Dead Cow text files, which were numbered. And then they would also package them up and distribute them to lots of other bulletin boards. So in Boston, the Works would be one place where you would read CDC files, but they're all over the place. And there really wasn't a good way to join. If you're interested, you would probably write a text file of your own, and maybe they'd publish it. It wasn't just members that wrote text files for them. And if you wrote a few of them and they're like you, they might sort of tap you on the shoulder and say, okay, you could join. But one of their rules after the earliest years was that anybody who asked to join could not join.
They call that the Groucho Marx rule, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So despite the fact that the thing is still going after more than 30 years, they only ever had 50 members or so.
So when I think back to the sort of the hacking scene, such as it was in the 80s or 90s, I mean, I think about groups of, you know, mostly teenage men, young men, you know, dumpster diving and trying to kind of get information about, you know, companies and using that to gain access to their, you know, internal network. It's almost kind of like the War Games type scenario. Was Cult of the Dead Cow doing that type of stuff? Were they doing the dumpster diving? Were they doing the recon or the social engineering a la Kevin Mitnick?
Yeah.
To gain access? Was that part of their MO?
It's a diverse group, and that's one of the things that makes it really interesting. I mean, in my view, like more interesting to write a book about than The Loft. The Loft was presentable. I mean, they could get invited to testify to Congress, as they did famously in 98. And then they turned pro with At Stake, right? So they have Microsoft as a customer. The CDC had some of the same people, but was like, you know, the dark side of the same drive. It was a very interesting media play, among other things, where if The Loft couldn't get you to take security seriously by publishing advisories, then, you know, meet my unkempt cousin CDC, who is going to like put on a costume and, you know, throw raw meat, literally raw meat, into the audience at DEF CON and throw out CDs that have Trojan programs. They're going to take advantage of your poor architect. That was a really savvy dynamic. And it actually wound up, while controversial and not without victims, actually drove security a lot.
I think the good cop, bad cop analogy is a very fitting one. So you'd kind of chart the evolution of this group from really more of a social organization with a lot of focus on sort of writing and publishing and music to one by the late 90s are publishing, you know, Black Orifice, a, you know, very powerful Windows hacking tool that got a lot of people, particularly in Microsoft world, very scared. So I guess talk about how that evolution happened.
The shift to the broad web in 95 basically wiped out the bulletin boards. The CDC text files survived because they're members of The Loft, and The Loft had one of the very earliest websites, as you can imagine. And so they, you know, they kept all the CDC files online. And then when it became like a bigger cultural phenomenon, or when anything did, when, like, you know, all these reporters started covering the internet and covering tech, you know, you looked around and CDC seemed to be emblematic of not just hacker culture, but internet culture, and they could explain it. Mm-hmm. And unlike many other hacker groups, CDC loved the media. CDC self-promoted. You know, they were like, yeah, hey, we're hackers. We'll explain stuff for you. And what was funny is that they would sort of meet the reporter wherever they were. So if you had a serious tech-savvy journalist who wanted to explain a security issue, they would explain it seriously. And if you had some TV reporter without a lot of experience who was looking, doing like a quick hit on, like, you know, what are these hackers all about? They would sometimes have fun. And they're like, you know, oh yeah, we can hack satellites and we can hack moving trains. And, you know, we're coming for you. We're coming for your children. You know, it was part of hacker culture and it was fun. But then once they got all that attention, then, you know, reporters was like, oh, would Google, like, what are hacking groups? And they come across them again. So they kept getting interviewed on TV over and over again. One of the really valuable thing about hackers is they tend to be critical thinkers, right? They're not just doing what the program tells them to do. They're trying to figure out how to trick the program into doing something else. And that expands not from technical stuff to media and society, and becomes really a broader issue of how can you hack other things. And Mudge and the others were interested in how you manipulate / hack the media, how you get a message across. And I think it was really for a defensible and important social purpose, which was that the incredible risk of running software, you know, sorry, Windows with TCP/IP and no real security built in, wasn't getting across to the public. I mean, it was being marketed as something that this is great and your grandma can get online. Nobody had a financial interest and telling grandma that she was also at risk. They thought, are there different ways of getting this message out there? And the bad cop CDC antics that create a media circus was actually a pretty effective way to do that. That kind of brings it back to Beto. And, you know, he told me that he thinks this is really valuable. This sort of perspective is very valuable. If you think our government is doing great and it's accomplishing everything it needs to do, then maybe you don't need somebody who thinks outside the system. But it seems to me, almost irrespective of politics, people are not really thrilled with Washington right now. And it's kind of a moment for outsiders. President Trump is an outsider. There are many people elected in 2018 who had never been in politics before, from left, from the right, whatever. And I think that hacking perspective, you see why that kind of perspective would actually be pretty appealing.
At the time that Beto was a part of the group, what would have been the ethos of CDC?
In that era, very early again, many of them were not actually breaking into computers. They were almost all of them stealing long-distance service, which in those days was actually a substantial amount of money. On the other hand, almost everybody was under 18 when they were doing this. There were a couple of members that got stern talkings to that had their computers taken away, and some of them like quit hacking after that. It was not the breaking into big companies era.
The stealing long distance, that was really just a practical concern, which is you needed to dial into these BBSs that might be all over the country, and so therefore you needed to use long distance connections to do it. Is that right?
That's right. You know, one of the reasons I picked CDC to write about is that I'm very interested in the ethics of security work, the ethics of hacking, and it's gotten really, really complicated, right? I mean, you make something and you've got some moral responsibility to see whether there's a hole in it or not, but that might not be what the sales guys care about. It might not be what the shareholders care about. And then you got things, you know, do you do business with China? Do you do business with the NSA? What happens when somebody asks for advance notice of a security flaw? There are a lot of really important ethical questions. And I think that, you know, kids who are getting into hacking today, 14, 15, a lot of them, I think, that don't know the history or think that, well, their career options are basically, you know, go work for the NSA, steal Bitcoin from each other, or try and get rich in Silicon Valley, all of which, you know, are perfectly reasonable choices. But I want them to think a little bit about the implications of what they do, because it's not just security work. As we've seen in the last year or so, Google, Facebook, all of these giant companies, Apple, are having to make really important philosophical calls. And there's just now starting to be demand for like in-house ethicists and, you know, philosophy professors. So I was using CDC because you can track the moral development of the people in it. And they wound up with making different calls about different things. But they're all debating it and trying to get it right. How much long-distance service is it acceptable to steal? How much harm am I really causing? Should I actually try to spread it out so that it's not just one person whose card I'm ripping off, but more people getting ripped off a little? And then when you get into blue boxes, red boxes, and other ways of stealing service, there's some guys in the book that say, well, okay, I'm going to sell these blue boxes that allow others to rip off phone companies, but I'm not going to sell it to drug dealers who really wanted it. And I'm going to reinvest all my profits to do more R&D, you know, and I'm not going to try and like make a living by selling blue boxes. But what's interesting is these guys, you can trace their history and see them making moral calls for smaller stakes like that. And then in 10 years, they're making calls about mass surveillance and cyber warfare. And you can understand which calls they made if you understand where they came from.
That's a really fascinating point. So you, I'm guessing as part of your research, read a lot of these so-called T-files or text files, which are the writings of Cult of the Dead Cow members, including Beto O'Rourke's. Some of the stuff, as you mentioned in your upcoming book, Joseph, that he wrote are troubling. He wrote a short story or anecdote about running over young children in his car and contemplating what a world without money might look like. I'm not sure how controversial that is. Having read a lot of T-Files by Beto and others, what are your thoughts both about the Cult of the Dead Cow writing in general and also where Beto kind of fits into their like ideological spectrum?
I don't think the text files are the most interesting part of the Cult of the Dead Cow. It's the part that is most easily accessible because they had the longest run of any text files. You know, you can find them, and they're interesting reading, some more than others. But, you know, a lot of these are written by 15-year-old kids, including the sort of alarming one by Beto. I'm not proud of much that I wrote when I was 15. You know, and it was written under a pseudonym. So the infamous car driving over kids one, it's a first person narrator.
Good distinction to make. Yes, it's a story from the perspective of somebody who's doing that. It of course isn't Beto saying I had a thought about this.
A lot of people think Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov is a hell of a book. I'm one of them. Is the narrator, you know, a child molester? You betcha. Not a nice guy. But it's also first person. You know, it's taught in universities around the world. You know, so, and it's also like, you know, it's four paragraphs, a ballpark, four paragraphs.
Oh, Lolita is much longer than four paragraphs, Joe.
Thanks. I am obviously talking about the car running over kids thing. You know, so it is what it is. You know, he's embarrassed by it. After my story ran, you know, he said he's embarrassed by it. I don't think that's who he is as a person today. People are free to come to their own decisions about how important that is. I think you basically have a bunch of teenagers who are broadly speaking, misfits, trying to find their place, interested in tech, curious, you know, excited to have some outlet where they can publish, as sort of came to the rest of the publishing world later in like the second half of the 90s. You don't need a printing press anymore. Anybody can write stuff. It's amazing. And they were very early on that, which meant that they explored it. And I actually think that's valuable today. You know, it was hard to get online back then. It was a pain. And it took some dedication. And so I give them props for that.
In the article you wrote last week, one of the really interesting things you try and do is sort of connect the dots between Beto and Cult of the Dead Cow and what that might mean from a policy perspective, both, you know, where he is right now as a politician or where he's been in his congressional career. And so one of the things you note is that he's very pro net neutrality and that speaks to his involvement in the very early days of, you know, the internet and so on. How do you think his membership in this group might translate into policy, again, were he to win his way to the Oval Office?
You know, one of the nice things I think about this whole story and his and sort of, you know, the piece of the book that's about him is that, you know, it's not like, you know, some super moralistic member of Congress has, you know, been exposed to like being a pimp or something like that. The stuff that I found out about him actually fits with what his public policy has been. I mean, he was very early on for legalizing marijuana. You know, he's pro net neutrality. There isn't anything that like contradicts what he wound up doing as a grown-up. Clearly, net neutrality, he understands the importance of technology in all phases, you know, all phases of modern life. The sort of the ability to get attention, again, sort of like hacking in the broader sense of like sort of consciousness and media awareness and that sort of thing. You know, I think if nothing else, it shows that he's willing to take an unconventional approach to issues that come before the White House should he actually win. I don't think he's going to be hidebound by tradition. I think that's fair. And I think he's also, you know, would take positions irregardless of where the ideas came from.
What is going on with Cult of the Dead Cow now? It's still around, but what is its function and what is the group up to?
Well, I'm afraid I've already given away a fair amount. And if you want to know all that stuff, then you're just going to have to buy the book.
Darn you, Joseph Menn. Joseph Menn of Reuters and the author of Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast.
You bet. Thanks for having me.